Up next, JX assistant producer Maddie Peterson offers a selection of short news features from around our region.
I'm Maddie Peterson. It's been just over a year since the Fairfax Bridge in rural Pierce County, Washington, was suddenly closed due to structural damage. KNKX's Mitch Borden reports.
On a rainy morning, Kent Taylor is struggling to unlock a large, heavy gate that's guarding a private dirt road.
Yeah, this thing's a little bit stiff and a little hard to do.
Dealing with this gate has become routine for people living south of the Fairfax Bridge. Ever since the bridge closed, there's been no way for the public to drive across the Carbon River Canyon, making this the only way residents can get in and out from their homes.
Some of the more ancient folks that live up there have problems with it, including myself.
Dozens of people own property deep in the forest back here. Many of them are seniors. That includes Taylor, who's 73, and his wife, 67-year-old Jill Cartwright. I hop in her car as she makes the drive to her house.
All right, you're going to close the gate?
I'll get the gate.
Thank you.
As Cartwright dodges potholes and inches along the narrow road, she recalls when the Fairfax Bridge closed. State officials shut down the bridge last year after finding a buckling support column and other damage. It happened suddenly. Cartwright had crossed it just hours before. Driving back, she found her way home barricaded off. She was shocked.
The first 6 months, I personally was like in fight or flight mode because we didn't know. We didn't know what was going to happen.
It could take the state 6 years to build a new bridge, and it could cost around $160 million. Officials are currently assessing whether to move forward with the project. So Cartwright and her neighbors are preparing to be on their own for a while. She's stocked up on supplies like fire extinguishers, bandages, and automatic defibrillators, AEDs for short. That's in case someone has a heart attack.
Nobody's going to be up here for an hour to help us. So we have 3 AEDs up here that we've gotten and asked for. So if we're close enough, we may be able to, you know, save somebody's life with the defibrillator.
A big part of Cartwright's preparations has been building relationships, like befriending a group of amateur radio operators who are visiting to help her install some radio equipment. Two-way radios have become an important part of communicating south of the bridge. One of the radio operators, Jamie Renwick, points out why.
There's no cell service out here. You know, you check your phone right now and there's nothing. It says no service.
You can make a phone call from certain spots, but locals need a more reliable way to reach emergency services. So Seth Ritchie, another radio operator, is working on installing an antenna up a tree to increase the broadcast range of their radios.
Climb all the way up into the top of up there and hopefully bring emergency communications into the community and make sure that if something were to go wrong, everyone can get help in a fast, efficient way.
76-year-old Mardell Chowan watches them work. She's lived out here for years and says it's been much more peaceful since the bridge closed. But the tranquility is bittersweet. Thousands of visitors used to pass through here on their way to remote sections of Mount Rainier National Park.
Hikers, bicyclists, families picnicking down along the river. There's just so much to do up here. And it's quieter, but I didn't mind the traffic because it meant people were going up to have fun.
One bright spot is that she's grown closer to her neighbors.
We're definitely more of a community, and we take care of each other. We know that now, you know. I'm not sure if we knew that before because, like I said, we're not all aligned with the same political spectrum.
Some locals fear that eventually they'll be forced to leave their homes. If a new bridge isn't built, the Washington State Department of Transportation may have to compensate residents if they lose access to their property, which could cost millions of dollars. That's only a possibility, but Chowan dreads the prospect of leaving.
My mother's ashes are spread up here. My ex-husband, my soulmate, I spread his ashes up here. This valley is a little special to me.
This is where Chowan wants to spend the rest of her life. And when she dies, she wants her ashes spread here too. I'm Mitch Borden, reporting.
For Latino farm workers across the U.S., trauma and inequities have long been part of daily life, intensified by the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, many are left confronting long COVID, a condition that's been difficult to diagnose and treat. Spokane Public Radio's Monica Carrillo-Casas reports.
The first time that Dr. Anita Chhabra had a long COVID patient, she cried. It was 2 years after the pandemic, she says, when the once healthy patient described symptoms of weakness, chronic fatigue, and frequently forgetting daily activities.
I still see him. He's in his late 40s, but the amount of change he dealt with, the challenges he's still struggling with, were just overwhelming.
Chhabra's a lead physician at the University of Washington Medicine's Long COVID Clinic based at the Harborview Medical Center. She is also a primary care provider at the university's primary care center in Shoreline. Researchers and physicians like Chhabra say they're still working to understand the long-term effects of COVID-19 and who is most affected. She says she's starting to see a broader pattern in which communities, like Latino farm workers, are hit hard by the virus. At UW Medicine, medical researcher Leo Morales has been studying how long COVID is showing up in those communities. According to his research, more than 2 in 5 agricultural workers are living with long COVID. That's one of the highest rates among occupations studied. And overall, more than 1 in 3 Latinos report long COVID, which is the highest rate among racial groups studied. Morales says early gaps in vaccine access and vaccine hesitancy both played a role in those disparities.
The best way to prevent long COVID is to prevent COVID in the first place. And vaccines are an important strategy.
At the only long COVID clinic in Washington state, Dr. Kendall Sankery says the wait list is long and the diagnosis process depends on the person. Sankery says she's had multiple patients who have worked with a primary care doctor and actually got to the point of at least suspecting long COVID as the diagnosis within a couple of months, meaning they could get the necessary referral for the UW clinic.
And then I have other patients where they've been dealing with these symptoms for, 4 years and haven't come to a clear diagnosis until they're able to get into our clinic.
For farm workers, the referral and wait lists isn't the only issue. Geography also plays a role. Many farm workers live in central and eastern Washington, far from Seattle, where the clinic is based. For a long period, referrals were limited to King County, further restricting access, Sankery says.
Which is unfortunate because I know the rates are higher in that group.
Beyond distance, a 2025 report from the Washington State Institute for Public Policy found that about 40% of farm workers lack health insurance. Chhabra says she dedicates 1 day a week to long COVID patients and sees about 6 people. Only about 6% of her patients have been Latino. Sankery, who sees about 16 patients a week, says she also sees very few Latino patients. Both providers say awareness and working conditions are part of the gap. In rural communities, people may not recognize long COVID symptoms or get referred for care at all. Chhabra calls delays in diagnosis among Latino farm workers a social determinant of health, shaped largely by their work.
They work in eastern Washington. It is very dry. They can manifest as asthma-like symptoms, shortness of breath. Sometimes they can have chest pain. Some of them experience heart racing for no reason. That impact of COVID on their lungs makes them more susceptible to the dry condition and all the dust as well that they are inhaling.
But Chhabra says their working conditions also raise a key question. Could pesticide exposure be to blame?
What we see in patients is some of them have asthma pre-existing and that can become aggravated after long COVID. Some patients who come in, they don't have any history of asthma, but now they have symptoms. Is this pesticide exposure? If they have reactive airways or new onset of asthma, then pesticide can add to it, which is why we will get a chest x-ray. We will refer them for lung function testing. But certainly pesticide exposure can superimpose on the already irritated lungs.
Sankery says that for farm workers, additional testing is important to determine whether symptoms match a clinical diagnosis, such as pesticide exposure. She says this is important because long COVID is often diagnosed based on symptoms alone. Still, Chhabra says farm workers often push through symptoms like fatigue, shortness of breath, and chest pain because that's what the work demands. And for many, taking time off to see a doctor just isn't an option.
These patients are also working and sometimes the only working member in the family. So they feel like they have to keep on working and tough it out.
And unfortunately, she says with long COVID, there's no such thing. Her first long COVID patient 4 years ago is a textbook case. I'm Monica Carrillo Casas, reporting.
The arrival of spring marks a period of new life. Flowers bloom, chicks hatch, and on sheep farms in Oregon, lambs are born.
Was that on the record?
KLCC's Julia Bobach visited one of these farms to find out what it means to birth new life, live off the land, and get closer to death as a farmer.
When Scotty Jones was working at the Phoenix Zoo, she never imagined moving with her husband Greg to Alsea, Oregon, much less becoming farmers. Her friends and family certainly couldn't believe it when she did, at 50 years old.
Our children thought we'd lost our minds. They were really mad at us for moving here.
After visiting the Leaping Lamb Farm in 2003, Jones fell in love with the nature, the weather, and the idea of growing her own food. But she says it didn't take long to realize she had been, quote, romantically deluded. She says the first 5 years on the farm were pure chaos. It seemed like everything that could go wrong did.
We didn't know what we were getting into. We really didn't. Everything fell apart. Everything was dramatic. Everything was tragic.
Jones remembers the first major incident.
Two of our dogs, they've got a sheep in the creek here. One of them's got her holding by the ear. The other one is like egging him on. And so we come running, we grab the sheep. I don't know how my daughter and I did it. We drag her out of this really deep end.
They were desperate for help.
I'm calling my brand new friend down the road and going, okay, I need a vet. And she goes, no, you don't. That vet's gonna cost you $150. You need to figure it out yourself. So that was our very first reality check.
Jones and her husband would face several obstacles in their first year. The horses opened their farm gates and got out, raccoons killed their chickens, and Jones had to learn how to help her ewes give birth. She kept her neighbors on speed dial for when things inevitably went wrong. At times, she wanted to give up, until she found out that's what people expected her to do.
Our friends back home were betting that we weren't going to stay. And we also found out that people here were wondering how long we were going to stay. So when I find out that people are betting against me, I dig my heels in.
Now, 23 years later, Jones says she's still seen as the lamb of the neighborhood, with several multi-generational farms and logging families in the area. But Jones has made a place for herself in the sheep farming community, and she's learned how to make a living off her land. The Leaping Lamb Farm sells meat from about 15 to 20 lambs a year directly to customers and visitors. But Jones's primary source of income comes from the farm stay she started in 2006. She says one reason for creating the two-bedroom cottage was to have people to talk to. But Jones has also learned lessons from her guests.
I'll watch people trying to help get the chickens into the chicken coop or try to help me with the sheep, and they're too fast, kids and adults. And I just go, slow down, slow down. So when you talk about what else have we gotten here, it's about learning how to slow down.
Her guests come from all over the country looking for respite. Joan says she notices them connecting with nature and each other in a more intentional way at the farm stay. Jones has also connected with the land and animals more intentionally. The lambs sold for meat complete their full life cycle at Leaping Lamb, and Jones tries to give them the best life possible before they're butchered and shipped away.
I just say they have a great life and one very bad day. And it's usually a pretty somber day on the farm.
Those days were especially hard for Jones early on. In Arizona, she says she wasn't accustomed to thinking about death or life in this way. But now she appreciates both more than ever.
What I think farming is about is it's gets you really close to life and death. It's so cyclical. It's plants living and dying. It's animals living and dying. It's just the whole landscape changing. I think I was very disconnected before I moved here.
Understanding this cycle has helped Jones improve the conditions of her farm and her own mentality. Now she knows the end of one lamb's life allows her to sustain others on the farm.
You know, people have said, do you regret that you did this? And no, I absolutely don't regret it. Not at all.
Through it all, the lessons and perspectives Jones has gained have made her healthier, happier, and more prepared for anything that comes her way. In Alsea, I'm Julia Bobach reporting.
That's it for today's Exchange. I'm Mike Green. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more, or you can subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts.